Today's episode is sponsored by Civic Engagement Podcast Future Hindsight. They're back with an all-new season on systemic racism in the U.S. Each week, they'll explore how the legacy of colonialism still permeates our country and how we can rectify it. This week, they look at the deep inequities in higher education and learn why education equality is the key to a thriving society. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts. And now, for this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 8th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Mark Rank, Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at the Brown School at Washington University in St. Louis, author. His most recent, Poorly Understood, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. Also on the program today, Senate passes a $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. Now back to the House for final approval on a vote tomorrow. 81% of that bill is earmarked for individuals and state and local government. It is expected to cut child poverty nearly in half. Meanwhile, another accusation by a former aide as calls mount for Andrew Cuomo's resignation. Trump sends a cease and desist letter to the RNC to stop using his likeness for their fundraising. Joe Manchin opens the door to filibuster reform. Georgia investigation into Trump's election interference down there heating up with the hire of a racketeering specialist. And jury selection taking place as we speak in the George Floyd murder trial. Joe Biden begins to disassemble the so-called migrant protection protocols that has 70,000 immigrants and asylum seekers stuck in Mexico. Lastly, in a headline, just tells too much by having to read it. The FDA now says it will now clamp down on heavy metals in baby food. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. There we go. It's rather quick. Thanks for joining us today. It's good to see you. Beginning of the week. Joining me, as always, back from her back issues.
Well, I was back.
Yeah, you're
Friday.
Back. The other day. I can't even remember what day it is today. Right. Emma Viglin is here. Emma, how are you? Hope all is well.
All is well. Before the show, we were discussing how the low-grade COVID anxiety is causing our bodies to break down. Again, I'm having some sort of arm ailment now. The back's a little bit better. Whatever.
I agree. I feel like my shoulder feels like it's about to fall off. My knee feels like it's about to fall off. I think this is an actual phenomenon, not the specifics of the shoulder and the knee, but there's a lot of low-grade anxiety out there. This pandemic is making it difficult. So self-care. Give yourself a break, folks, if you haven't done as much as you think you should on any given day. Obviously, keep in mind those people who, you know, are still our first responders and are, you know, necessary workers. Many people getting vaccinated. Nearly, I think, 100 million doses now have been deployed, and it is ramping up. And you can see it in terms of just the numbers of people who are getting vaccinated. Of course, we still have this problem where there are some states where they're just simply rolling back and relaxing a little bit earlier. This is, you know, it's a metaphor I think that you would use, Emma, but you got a lot of people spiking the ball on the 20-yard line.
Yeah.
And you might want to wait until you're in the end zone. But that said, I just got a notice that New York City high schools going back to in-person, reopen for in-person learning beginning Monday, March 22nd. So we will see. At least that's a couple of weeks out. There's been a lot of vaccination happening in New York City and state, and hopefully we'll see even more over the next couple of weeks, but we will see. But the big story, of course, today is that over the weekend, there was passage in the Senate of the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. We have spent a lot of time talking about what is missing from that bill, both from a political and policy perspective. The $2,000 check as opposed to the $1,400 check, which I think, you know, from my perspective is there are other mechanisms for people to get money in this bill. I mean, if you are a family of four and earning about $50,000 a year, you could be looking at close to $20,000 worth of money coming in various different forms. We will talk about this as the show progresses and over the next couple of days. But
the average family of four, most families of four, $5,600.
$5,600. That's correct.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there is no $15 minimum wage, which is has political implications. But from a policy standpoint, we have millions and millions of people in this country who are working at wages that are not livable wages. And that seems to be something that needs to be corrected. This bill, supposedly, and we have, fortunately, an expert on the program today, there are claims that this bill will cut child poverty by 45%. Now, it also sort of begs the question, well, if you cut it by 45%, why wouldn't you cut it by 100%?
Yeah,
but
there are varying degrees. I think the Washington Post cited a Columbia University study that said it would cut it by one third. But either way, I mean, it's a good bill. I think it didn't go far enough. The needless trampling on oneself from a political standpoint of making these checks $1,400 instead of $2,000. Ridiculous. The fact that the $15 minimum wage isn't included is not enough. But to deny the good things in this bill, I think, you know, would be to deny reality. There's going to be a significant bump for working people, for families, in terms of the money that they're going to be getting and right directly into their pockets.
The real question, and you know, of course, we all should say that ramp down on the $1,400 checks. The real question is going to be, this Senate will have an opportunity at this, make these, particularly when you talk about, there's going to be $300 monthly payments for 90 some odd percent of children in the country. And it actually is a little bit higher for younger children. It's going to happen for a year. The question is, can we make that permanent? Maybe bump it. We'll see.
It's, as you described to me before the show, UBI, a testing UBI strategy for children.
Yep.
And that's big. That's big. Not everything's big or earth-shattering in this bill, but I think that is a seismic shift in terms of Democratic policy.
And a lot of it has to do with just the complete absence of any type of pushback from Republicans. You know, they're still caught up in this whole Mr. Potato Head slash Dr. Seuss issue, which, you know, Democrats, to be fair, Democrats have completely failed to address it.
You're right. You're right. It actually, they really are occupying this space, and the Democrats are going to really lose all those Mr. Potato Head single issue voters. Or, I'm sorry, I'm sorry for misgendering Potato Head.
Right.
Just Potato Head.
And here is an example of sort of the lamest attempt at the austerity politics that have been completely obliterated, in part because of Donald Trump, in part because we're living in a pandemic. But they're still trying to play the hits over at Fox and Friends. And what's fascinating about this is just sort of how lackluster this is, because there, well, you play this. This is clip number six.
Washington Post headline, Biden stimulus showers money on Americans, sharply cutting poverty and defining move of presidency. So what is in this relief bill? $350 billion going to state and local governments, $270 million. Keep in mind, this is COVID relief. $270 million going to arts and humanities, $200 million Institute of Museum and Library Services, $91 million student loan outreach, $50 million environmental justice grants, $10
million. 1 second. Now, leave it up there. Just take a look at this. $350 billion state and local governments. Some of that's going to help, hopefully, with getting vaccinations out there. They have more money that's specifically earmarked for vaccinations. And then they actually have to go down. Remember, this is a $1.9 trillion bill. I remind you that Ron Johnson spent a lot of time trying to explain people to provide a metaphor for it. It's extremely one of the most
I don't see the checks or child poverty payments that's being outlined there. They're focusing on things that they can deem extraneous.
What's fascinating is that they've listed here, out of the $1.9 trillion, $350 in state and local governments, and then about $600 million, which I can't even do the math on how little that represents in the context of a $1.9 trillion bill. I don't know. It's not even like a nickel out of a dollar.
Please don't ask me to do math.
It is. I don't think that we have small enough currency, if I was to use a dollar as an example, as to what that represents. But this is how desperate they are. But continue.
Preservation of Native American languages. But Dan Crenshaw, he summed it up. His tweet says, the COVID package costs every single American $5,750 and then gives some people $1,400. No, Biden isn't a leprechaun. He's just bribing you with your own money and footing your kids with the bill and some inflation to top it off.
And that's such a good point. The Washington Post makes this point today. This thing injects so much money into the economy at a time when we do not necessarily need it. Economists from both parties warn that the growth could overheat, leading to hard to contain inflation, Ainsley, which you just mentioned. Plus, some businesses say that the government aid is so generous, they cannot get the unemployed people to come back to work. And so they're going to stay on the sideline and just get the checks.
What I just don't understand is how you could do this story and host a Sunday show and not bring up the fact that only 9% goes to pandemic relief, not bring up the fact that $1 trillion from past plans has yet to been spent. Why would you not bring up the fact that we right now are beginning to come out of it with vaccines and we should be responsible in not spending money that we don't have? At least pose that is part of the story. As opposed to ignoring that.
Well, luckily, we're doing the story.
We're $28 trillion in debt, so this is money that your grandkids or your kids are going to have to pay for.
How much money do you think the Democratic Party would have to spend to get Fox and Friends, or just to get the word out that, like, you're being showered with cash, America? And, like, I mean, and the problem with Dan Crenshaw is saying they're taking $5,600 and giving you $1,400 is that the vast majority of Americans are going to be getting significantly more than $1,400. And by significantly more, I mean a multiple of $1,400. That, like I said, some of them are going to get up to $20,000+. Family of four is going to get a minimum of $5,600. The unemployed are going to get that check plus the extra $300 per week and a fix on the taxes. The Democrats can't even message that. They should be out there talking about Biden bucks or whatever it is. And there is no coherent message by the Republicans as to why this is problematic, except for some vague notion of this is money we don't have to spend. Well, in a couple of weeks, the people getting the money are just, that's just not going to be something that's going to be in the forefront of their minds.
No, they're going to see the check in their bank account, and they're not going to think about that terrible math average that Dan Crenshaw tried to use to obfuscate the point, because I don't know if you know this, high wage earners who put money into the system ostensibly, even though not enough, they're not getting these checks. So a lot of this is going to be coming from the rich to regular people. The little that the rich do pay in taxes anyway. And this could all have been framed as you're getting some of your tax money back at a time when you need it. This is basically a one-time tax cut for people. But Fox isn't going to frame it that way, neither is Dan Crenshaw.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Mark Rank, the Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at the Brown School at Washington University in St. Louis, author of Poorly Understood, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. Meanwhile, today's show, sponsored by Third Love. Third Love uses the measurements of millions of women to design bras with all-day comfort and support. Every Third Love bra is made with the signature memory foam cups. And they have no slip straps and a scratch-free band in a variety of sizes. You've heard us talk about their Fit Finder quiz, and now Third Love just launched the Fitting Room, which is a new and improved version of the quiz that many of you all know and love. The Fitting Room has helped 18 million women find their true bra size. You could be one of those next. Plus, Third Love's team of experts, fit stylists, they're available via chat or email. They will answer all of your questions. And they're also introducing Lounge by Third Love. You can mix and match styles and your official uniform for anything you feel like doing. From the couch to weekend outings, it's loungewear that's made to wear everywhere.
Oh my goodness, I am a sucker for loungewear. I will spend my paycheck on loungewear.
I'm not sure I fully grok that, but to be honest with you, with the loungewear,
it's like sweatpants but cute ones for women.
Oh, well, there you go. That explains it. Well, I don't know if you're aware of this. I do not have much experience with bras. However, our one of our multiple bra trier honors and experts had this to say. She wrote me, the idea that I had 60 days to try out the bras drew me in, but in the end, I don't think I've had a better experience buying clothes online, certainly not when it comes to bras. The Fit Finder worked like a charm. Choice of styles, amazing. And now there's the Fitting Room, so that's been even upgraded. But everyone who's actually the two people that we've had to try the bras, that's exactly what they said. Like, they never get bras that fit the first time around. But she wrote, both the bras I ordered were a perfect fit. They're incredibly comfortable and cute and subtle.
The Fit Finder app or the mechanism that they use is very helpful, I would say.
It's, my daughter also had a great experience with it, but Third Love knows your one true fit is out there. So why are they? So right now they're offering my listeners 20% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra. Get 20% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 20% off today. Also, you all know Liquid IV for their popular hydration mix. There's a ton of it consumed around here.
It's in my cup right now.
Well, Liquid IV's Energy Multiplier is an absolute game changer, and it gives you that extra boost we all need. One stick is like drinking two cups of coffee, and it's an all-natural alternative to processed energy drinks for a sustained energy boost throughout the day. Ladies and gentlemen, now, right now, I am dealing with, I'm trying to cut down on my caffeine usage, so I'm using one for like this huge bottle. But as you know, regular go-to for me, the Energy Multiplier, it's a healthier alternative to traditional energy drinks and coffee. There are no artificial flavors, no artificial preservatives. Premium matcha and green energy blend tastes delicious. That is absolutely true. Provides a lasting energy boost. Liquid IV's cellular transport technology delivers an optimal ratio of nutrients for more efficient uptake. You can use the energy multiplier to help you power your mornings, or maybe to get through a 3-hour podcast, fuel long days at work, get a boost for those tough workouts. It's non-GMO, it's vegan, it's free of gluten, free of dairy, free of soy. Plus, the company has donated over 10 million servings globally. Check it out, folks. Tastes delicious, gives me that energy boost, and also gets me hydrated while all that's happening. It's like a threefer. Is that what we call it?
Maybe.
Grab your Energy Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MajorityRep, not Majority Report, MajorityRep at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you use the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Start fueling your adventures today at liquidiv.com. Promo code MajorityRep. Lastly, whether you're an early bird or you like to hit the snooze button, everyone deserves to sleep in ultimate comfort, and that starts with your comforter. Brooklinen can help you get your best sleep. Brooklinen creates beautiful, high-quality bedding, home essentials. I've gone fully Brooklinen now. They work directly with manufacturers to give you a fair price. No middlemen, no markups. Their comforters come in lightweight, all season, and ultra warm to suit every type of sleeper and lifestyle. Not that anybody cares, but I'm a lightweight. I mean, I'm not personally a lightweight. I use the lightweight comforter. There's even a weighted comforter for option for stress relief. That sounds fascinating to me. They also offer a variety of materials, including an eco-friendly recycled down alternative. Brooklinen's comforters pair perfectly with their sheets, pillows, and duvet covers. There's a reason Brooklinen has over 75,000 five-star reviews and counting. Folks, Brooklinen, I now have gone fully Brooklinenized. I use the crisp, clean, cool sheets as opposed to the more softer ones, I guess. I don't know. I mean, these are soft, but they're cooler. They're all cotton. I don't know how to express it.
I have Brooklinen sheets as well, as we've discussed.
Folks, you can treat yourself to the ultimate comfort with Brooklinen's comforter collection. Go to brooklinen.com, use the promo code MajorityReport to get $25 off with a minimum purchase of $100. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Enter the promo code MajorityReport. You get $25 off with a minimum purchase of $100. That's brooklinen.com, promo code MajorityReport. All right, do we have the professor? Like to welcome to the program Mark Rank. He is the Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at the Brown School at Washington University in St. Louis. The author of his latest, Poorly Understood, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. Mark, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
And joining me, of course, Emma Vigeland. Thank you for being here today. It's rather fortuitous. We've got this $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill that has passed in the Senate over the weekend. I want to get to that and ask you, what the implications of that are. But first, let's address what's in your book. And we should say this is co-authored with Lawrence Eppard and Heather Bullock as well. But let's start with this. What are some of the myths that we have about poverty?
Well, there's a lot of them, but the one that we start out with is the myth that, you know, poverty is something that happens to somebody else, that it doesn't happen to me, that I'm not really affected by it. And what we show in the book is in the very first chapter that actually a majority of Americans at some point in their lives will experience a year below the poverty line. So between the ages of 20 and 75, 60% of Americans will fall at some point into poverty, and 3/4 of Americans will experience either poverty or near poverty. So the idea that poverty is something that happens to some other group and doesn't affect me at all is not at all correct.
What are the the myths surrounding the demographics? Like who are those 60%? who will pass through poverty at one point in their lifetime?
Yeah, so a lot of times we think of poverty as a black problem, a brown problem, that folks of color are what the majority of people in poverty are. It turns out that actually the largest group in poverty are whites. Now, it's certainly true that if you're non-white, you're at a much greater risk of experiencing poverty. But whites are the largest group in poverty. And if you look at where people live in terms of poverty, we often think, oh, they live in high poverty neighborhoods in inner city areas. It actually turns out that there are more people now in poverty that live in suburban areas than in central cities. And some of the deepest seated poverty is actually found in rural America, in Appalachia, the Deep South, American Indian reservations. So the reach of poverty is actually really wide. It affects a lot of different folks at a lot of points in time.
You cite a statistic that says the result is that the bottom 60% of Americans own less than 1% of the entire financial wealth of the country. That's an unbelievable statistic. I mean, we've heard a lot of things that supplement that data. But you write that that's a large result of economic mobility being so stagnant in the United States. Can you talk about that statistic and how it plays into that phenomenon?
Yeah, great question. So, yes, it's true that the bottom 60% of Americans own less than 1% of the financial wealth. And financial wealth is everything you've got, stocks, savings, bonds, except for your the value in your house. The top 5% of Americans own 3/4 of the entire financial wealth in the United States. And part of the problem is that if we think about the ladder of opportunity and the rungs on that ladder, they've been getting wider and wider apart from each other. And so it's become more difficult for Americans now to climb that ladder of opportunity. So we actually find less economic mobility in the United States today than in many other high economy countries. For example, Denmark has much more economic mobility than in the United States. And this is really, you know, this is really troubling because the American dream is based on that idea that if you work hard, you play by the rules, you can move ahead in your life. And it turns out that's becoming harder and harder to do.
Well, can you do we have a comparison of that dynamic from instead of like cross country, but relative to the United States? Like when has there been in this country legitimately that opportunity to move so fluidly?
Yeah. So if you look at there's been some work done on this question using this a lot of big data. So we can have a lot of confidence in that. So children that were born in the 1940s, almost all of them did better as adults economically and earned more as adults economically than their parents did. And this is controlling for inflation and all that. In the 1950s, that became a little less true. In the 1960s, by the time of the 1980s, only about half of that generation is going to do economically better than the previous generation. So what we've seen is that over the last 50 years, because of a lot of the economic changes that have been going on, it's again become more difficult for folks to do better than their parents did.
Well, what are those changes? I mean, why does poverty in this system exist? I mean, you know, we are the wealthiest country in the world. Is this endemic to the system?
Yeah. So I think there are two big reasons for why this exists. First of all, over the last 50 years, we've been producing more and more low-wage jobs, jobs that just can't support a family, that don't have benefits, that make it much more difficult to get by on. The other thing is that we do much less to try to protect people from falling into poverty. What we do is we punish people who fall into poverty. Whereas a lot of other countries, you know, have a pretty robust social safety net. And here's the way I like to explain this. picture a game of musical chairs where we have 10 players, but 8 chairs. They circle around, music stops, 2 players lose out. Okay, who's going to lose out? Well, it's going to be somebody with less speed, less agile, and so on. And we can say those were the reasons why those 2 folks left out. But given the structure of the game, it doesn't really matter what the characteristics are. 2 people are going to lose out. And that's what we've been doing in this country. We've been playing a game of musical chairs where the structure of the game is set up so that more and more people are going to lose out. Now, those who lose out have less education and skills and so on. But that ultimately is not the reason. It has to do with the structure, as I said before, of the economy and what we do in terms of social policy.
Is that, I mean, when we say that, are we talking about capitalism? I mean, when we talk about the idea of a safety net as opposed to a floor, right? Because safety net implies like you have to be falling to sort of like hit that net, as opposed to like it's a floor. This is just where we decide as a society, like this amount of stuff, whatever it is, healthcare, housing, food, cash, that's just the floor. And then from there, you know, if you want to jump up, but there is no falling down.
Yeah, I mean, you're right on target here in that the floor that we have in the United States is much, much lower than the floor that other sort of high economy countries have. So you have to ask the question, why is it that we don't provide universal health care? Almost every other country does. Why is it that we don't provide assistance for childcare or affordable housing? We don't provide that kind of floor that protects people from falling below that. And the question is, well, why don't we? And that's an interesting question that we take up in the book. I think one, there's a couple explanations for this, but one is that we've been steeped in rugged individualism and the idea of self-reliance. And you do it on your own. You don't depend on others or the government. And so we're very reluctant to provide those kinds of programs and policies that protect folks.
Do you think that rugged individualism, though, has become less of the hamstringing of our lawmakers than political corruption has? I mean, one, you can posture, yes, is this inherent to capitalism? But also, it seems like the fact that we've allowed basically unlimited donations to our politicians from the interests that want to keep the stratification of our economy and keep poverty at these levels that depend on basically indentured servitude of wage workers, that may be a more dominating factor because it's so tangible.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, there's no question that, you know, money has definitely had a corrupting influence on our democracy. But I think you're bringing up an interesting point, which is this question of who might benefit from these poverty myths. So we go through the book and we go through a whole bunch of myths and basically show that there's no support for any of these myths. The question then is, well, how come these myths persist? And one reason is that some folks have really benefited from these myths. So certainly politicians have played on this over and over, the idea of the welfare freeloader. Ronald Reagan played on that, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump. But also the idea that, you know, that this is a meritocracy and people get what they deserve. Well, that's a really nice justification for the status quo of inequality and poverty. Whereas if you step back and you say, wait a minute, this is not necessarily a meritocracy. There's some structural problems here. Then that implies that we need to do something about the status quo. So I think this is a really important question of why these myths continue and who benefits from these myths.
How much of those myths are racialized? But I want to talk about that. But getting to the structure, because I think that your analogy or the metaphor of the musical chairs. Yeah. The bottom line is there's 10 people and you only put out 8 chairs. After that decision, everything else is just sort of like commentary, right? Like, we're going to come up with, we're going to backfill the reason why these two people didn't get those chairs. But we all know the reason why two people, you know, maybe those two people didn't get those chairs. But the reason why two people didn't get the chairs is because we only had eight chairs. But right. To be clear, like, we are a country that could afford 10 chairs. We just decide not to, right? And then everything else is just sort of our rationale.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. It's we have the resources. We are a wealthy country. We could do something about this, but we don't have the political will or the societal will. And one of the reasons for that is what our book is really about, which is that we've been blinded by these myths as opposed to the realities. So I think that's exactly right. That we could certainly do something to address poverty, but we need to have the political will, and we also need to have the correct diagnosis. So this is like, you know, if a doctor has the wrong diagnosis, the patient isn't going to get any better. And our diagnosis has been, well, you just need to work harder. You need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's the answer. Well, that hasn't been working. We have the highest rates of poverty of all the OECD or high economy countries, you know, the European countries, Canada, and so on. We have the highest rates of poverty. We have the greatest depth of poverty, the most extreme poverty of those countries, and we have the widest inequality.
How is it that those myths are if it is the myths, right? And maybe it's a combination of the myths and what Emma suggested, that there's simply just too much power vested in the hands of few who have influence over this. But if it is the myths, like, where were those myths 100 years ago, 80 years ago? How did the myth of, you know, self-reliance at a time where it's like, you know, 80 years ago, you washed your, you know, if you had a washing machine, it was like, wow, that's, you know, if you had like the it seems to me just as a, just a matter of course, you had to be more self-reliant 100 years ago or 150 years ago because of the, you know, than you are today. How is it the myth has grown when it really is clear that we're not nearly as self-reliant as just a species, I guess, but certainly as in America? How has that myth grown to the point where things have changed over the course of 50 years, if it's really the myths? Yeah. Or is there sort of like the myths are just sort of like really just window dressing?
Yeah, so yeah, it's really interesting. I would say that, you know, certainly from the get-go in this country, you know, we've had a strong streak of individualism and self-reliance. But I would say that I would point to the more recent history of really Ronald Reagan's rise to power in the presidency in 1980. The idea there was we need to have smaller government. And therefore, the myth that, well, government programs corrupt individual initiative fits really well with that goal of smaller government. So the conservative agenda over the last 50 years has been, you know, this one of smaller government. And that dovetails with the idea of these myths that people are poor because it's their own fault, they're not working hard enough, and so on. So I think that that's what we've been seeing over the last 50 or 60 years. And it'll be interesting to see how this may change in the next 2 or 4 years with a kind of a new focus on these kinds of things. The other thing I want to mention is, and you touched upon this, but I think it's a really important point, is that so often in this country, we have equated the issue of poverty with race. And race has been used to divide poor whites and poor blacks from seeing their common interests. This has been done over and over, particularly in the South. And I have a really great quote from Lyndon Johnson about this whole thing, because I think this is so relevant today. So he was talking to an aide in 1960, and he says, "I'll tell you what's at the bottom of it. If you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you." And that's exactly what we've seen over the last decades.
It's fascinating, too, because the only thing that we've seen deployed in terms of pushing back on this COVID-19 bill is that disincentive that supposedly unemployment will create for people to go back to work, presumably when it's safe, right? I mean, it's on some level, it's what the part that they leave off that sentence is like, you know, we want to create that incentive for people to go back to work, despite the fact that they could get a deadly disease. But let's talk about the you write about the cost of poverty.
Oh, yeah.
And that is both, it's expensive to be poor as an individual, and it's also expensive for a society to have people who are living in poverty. Explain both of those dynamics.
Yeah, this is such an important question. So first of all, yes. The ironic thing is that if you're in poverty, it costs a lot. It costs a lot in terms of time and just having to pay more for certain things, not having, you know, grocery stores, maybe in your neighborhood, all of that. But the other way that's really important is, what does poverty cost us economically in our society? And so a couple of years ago, I did a study where we estimated what the overall economic cost of childhood poverty was in the United States. We know that childhood poverty is associated with higher healthcare costs. It's associated with less economic productivity when children become adults, and it's associated with higher criminal justice costs. So we factored all those in, and what we found was that the annual cost, and this was a conservative figure, the annual cost of childhood poverty was slightly over $1 trillion. This is on an annual basis. To put that in perspective, that's about that was about 28% of the entire federal budget. So the issue here is, it's not like we're not paying for this. But what we're doing is we're paying for poverty on the back end of the problem rather than on the front end of the problem. And it's always more expensive to pay for something on the back end of the problem. The other thing that we showed was that for every dollar we spend reducing childhood poverty, we would save between $7 and $12 down the road. So not only is reducing poverty the morally right thing to do, it's also the economically smart thing to do.
Does that message, I mean, if it is the case, right, that the reason why we have poor people is because, or people living in poverty, I should say, the reason why we have people living in poverty is a function of our society deciding to keep using this, your analogy, to deploy 8 chairs when we have 10. Isn't it that maybe it's not a question for those people who are deciding that we're going to put out 8 chairs, that it's not a question of like how much it's going to cost society? It's a question of its knockoff impact on being able to push resources in one specific direction. In other words, when we deploy 8 chairs, yes, it may be more expensive down the road for society. But what it does in the meantime is it creates a certain amount of anxiety that allows us to to profit off of that, to maximize our profits, because that anxiety pushes people into work. It disempowers them. It creates a mismatch in terms of the dynamic between those who have and those who don't.
Yeah, that's also very interesting. I teach a course on poverty and inequality here. And one of the explanations for why poverty exists from some folks is that it serves some function. So, you know, if you have a large group of people in poverty or near poverty, who's going to do those low wage jobs? Well, they don't have much choice. And by focusing on that, it keeps, you know, prices down and so on and so forth. So, you know, I think it's a really important question in terms of who is benefiting from this, who benefits from this. But again, what I would say is that, yes, it's true that some folks benefit from poverty, but overall, the general cost of poverty is so much higher. I mean, think about it, you know, in the sense of the most important investment we can make is in our human potential and in our children's potential. And by doing that, it makes us, again, not only a better society, but it makes us a more productive society. People are more innovative, more creative, all kinds of things. And other countries invest so much more in their children and in their people than we do in the United States. And it's going to become harder and harder to remain economically competitive if we write off a large segment of the population.
This diverges for us in the 1980s, right? I mean, we were theoretically still in the game, as it were, relative to these other countries. Mm-hmm. And certainly we didn't have any type of universal health care. Maybe by, you know, we had just, I guess, you know, 15 years before Ronald Reagan, we had passed Medicare, which arguably could have been a first step to that type of thing. What happened during the 70s? Was it just, you know, Ronald Reagan shows up and he says a couple words and then, you know, we're completely off track? Like, what happened during the 70s that structurally change that allowed for, you know, if we have an understanding that the myths surrounding poverty are deployed because we want to sort of obscure certain choices that are made, again, to put out 8 chairs instead of 10, what happened during that period?
Well, I think there was, it's a really interesting question. I don't pretend to have the ultimate answers to it, but I think that there was, you know, a backlash to the 1960s. You know, the 1960s were a time where we had the war on poverty, but we also had a lot of racial turmoil, but a lot of progress in terms of civil rights. And I think that there was a backlash. And I think that that definitely Ronald Reagan tied into that backlash, you know, sort of the white blue collar workers that kind of switched over to the Republican Party. And again, as I said earlier, I think that we've sort of been in this kind of conservative mode over the last 40 or 50 years. But I think if you look at politics over a long period of time, we tend to go in cycles. And my guess is I'm guardedly optimistic that we're actually moving into more of a progressive cycle where we will really start to address these fundamental issues instead of the idea of, you know, that we so often do, and Donald Trump was notorious for this, for scapegoating particular groups. We're saying, oh, you know, he certainly tapped into the idea that people haven't been getting ahead economically. That's certainly true. But the root of the problem is not immigration or some other group. It's structural, and it has to do with not enough jobs that pay a decent wage, and we need policies that focus on that.
Well, there's been a reaction by the Democrats, and there has been a shift. I mean, I think we're all seeing it, and for those of us who cover the Democratic Party and have, there is extremely cautious, I don't know if you could get more cautious than us, but optimism that there seems to be an understanding that these systemic problems need to be addressed. Like Chuck Schumer, this is a quote from him in the Washington Post today. What happened in 2009 and 10 is we tried to work with the Republicans. The package ended up being much too small, and the recession lasted for 5 years. People got sour. We lost the election. I mean, that's a kind of unthinkable shift if you were to be talking about the Democratic Party even 4 years ago. So are you sensing that the Overton window has kind of shifted? It will be different outside of a crisis mode, but at least in this crisis mode, they seem to be somewhat getting it.
Yeah, I think that's for sure. You know, the idea of that's now, you know, people are talking about the idea of a universal basic income. I mean, a few years ago, that would be like, this is, you know, radical. There's no way. People are now talking about this. Both President Biden and Senator Romney have a proposal to provide a child allowance. That what that does is it gives folks with children a monthly payment to help in terms of raising those children. Now that's been around in European countries for decades, but for the United States and for actually proposals on both sides of the aisle, that's different. That's new. And so, yes, I'm guardedly optimistic that there is now discussion about this. And there's a recognition, which is what we're getting at the book and what we've been talking about this last, you know, 25 minutes. There's a recognition that there aren't enough chairs for the players that are playing the game. And we need to focus on that rather than continually focusing on who loses out at the game.
In fact, we should say that that provision, not as structured by Romney, I think Romney had a was going through the Social Security system as opposed to the IRS. But my understanding is that within the COVID bill, you get $300 a month for children between, I think, 6 and 18 years old, maybe $360 a month, a little bit more, $380 if the child's under 6. And that's just for 1 year. But there is been the administration has expressed the desire to keep that going after this 1 year. So tell me, like, what do we have now in terms of any type of policies, as inadequate as they are, to help people not be in poverty? And then let's talk about, like, you know, what this COVID relief bill, if it was to be extended, if these provisions, the $300 a month, and we should say there's always been child tax credits, but this is a monthly payment, which makes it much easier to smooth out those expenses over the course of the year, as opposed to, like, maybe I'll get it at the end of the year, maybe I won't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly right. That's a huge difference of getting sort of a payment at the end of the year versus on a monthly level. So the program that we have now, which is the largest anti-poverty program, is something that a lot of people might not be aware of, but it's the earned income tax credit. And that's what you're talking about, is that if you're a low-income worker and you earn below a certain level, you get a refundable tax credit at the end of the year. And that's actually been a pretty effective program in getting and raising the wages of folks. But again,
We say refundable tax credit, I feel like people just don't understand what that means. It just basically means you get a payment, you get a check, right?
Right. So, but you do have to file taxes to get it. You don't have to owe anything. That's the difference. So it's not just like cutting your taxes down. You actually get a check at the end of the year, from that program. But, you know, as you're pointing out, that's different and that's certainly very valuable, but getting something on a monthly basis to help raise children is, would be a huge advantage for so many folks. And as I said, this is an idea that has been, that European countries have been doing this for decades. So this isn't some kind of, you know, new idea, but it's been shown to be really effective. And it doesn't, you know, people oftentimes think, well, this is have an incentive on people working and so on. And the evidence shows that it doesn't have any of those kinds of effects, that they're very, very minimal, that people use that in a productive way. So, so I think that's, you know, again, it's very positive that we're starting to talk about it and actually have some proposals out there.
What else do you see in this COVID bill, or what don't you see in this COVID bill that you think that would be if you had an opportunity for a next step, like what would you deploy at this point?
Yeah. So the thing that jumps immediately to my mind is the $15 minimum wage that, you know, as President Biden says, it's fundamentally wrong that you should work full time in this country and still be in poverty. And, you know, if you're working below that level, almost by definition, you're in poverty. So I think that is the next big thing that we need to address, is to get the wages up to something that is a reasonable level. You know, the minimum wage hasn't been raised since 2009. It's $7.25 an hour on the federal level. There's just no way. And this would impact millions and millions of folks and would help them dramatically. So I think that to me is the next really big thing. And again, going back to our analogy, that is getting at this idea of providing more chairs in the musical chairs analogy. So I think that's key.
Well, why not? As opposed to, like, you know, $15 minimum wage, which is like a second order solution, right? I mean, why not, as a society, decommodify certain things so that those chairs, are just not as important to provide a place for someone to sit? You know what I mean? Like, you're putting out eight chairs with backs on it. What if you just put out some big benches and said, you know, if you want backs on your chairs, then you can work on it. But everybody has room on the bench. In other words, everyone has health care. Everybody has a baseline of support, whether it's maybe it's housing, maybe and housing, or certain things that the government provides in terms of energy, things that we just don't have to think about. We just have them in the same way that we have a right to, you know, pack a firearm, let's say, or something like that. And then these other questions are, you know, second order questions, but they become far less relevant because you have a certain baseline for everybody.
Yeah, that's I think that's right on target. You know, as we were talking about earlier, the United States does not provide these kind of baseline things. So in a way, you know, when I say that poverty in the United States is much worse than in other countries, not only are we talking about income, but we're talking about all these things that you're raising here. So absolutely, you know, when we think about the future and what needs to be done. So, yes, livable wages is critical. But having universal health care is, you know, so important. Having affordable and accessible child care is really critical. In this country, again, we kind of leave it up to families to figure it out on their own, as opposed to providing really good quality child care that a number of countries, France, Denmark, Scandinavian countries, all provide. And affordable housing is the other, I think, really big component in all of this. You know, as you know, a housing in particular in some areas has just become astronomical and people can't afford it. So we need to really grapple with that. And these are tough issues. But, you know, again, I think we can look at examples of other countries that have been able to do this.
I think that basically covers it. I mean, is there what are the things? I mean, I guess in terms of that COVID-19 relief, the biggest thing is that that earned income tax credit, like, deployed on a monthly basis. I mean, of all the things in this limited bill, that's the one that you would want extended, I imagine.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, as we pointed out, you know, the idea of a child allowance right now in the bill is just for a year, but being able to continue that would be really fantastic.
Mark Rank, the book is Poorly Understood: What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Sam. It was great.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and Emma and I will be back to wrap this up. So the Professor Rank made the point, or at least his, I guess, sense is, and this definitely being, you know, sold this way. And I think part of it is, like he says, cyclical, and there's generational questions here. And obviously, I think COVID, a combination of Donald Trump and the Republicans passing this massive tax cuts for wealthy without any hesitation about the deficit or debt,
which they've been screaming about for
years and years. And I would add also a broader understanding and acceptance of modern monetary theory, which suggests that deficit and debts are not as dangerous as had been previously thought. I would even go to that paper. I think it was Reinhardt and Rogoff, the one that suggested at a certain, if your debt was a certain percentage of your GDP, your economy was about to tank. And then, which was the sort of centerpiece of the austerity push by Democrats in the Obama administration in 2010.
And reflected in the European Union as well. I mean, this was international.
That's true. In this country in particular, that research was touted in the halls of the Senate. And then subsequent to that, somebody found out there was simply literally an error on the spreadsheet. And no, their findings were not true. All of these things have come together and culminated in this COVID relief bill, which is, you know, we've talked about the limitations of it, but there is serious potential in it. And here is Joe Scarborough, who came in as part of the class of representatives that came in with Newt Gingrich, the Contract for America class. I think it was in 94. And here he is on Morning Joe. He was a congressman in that era. Really a guy I would imagine would say that he was inspired by Ronald Reagan. Here's clip number one.
It's history bending. I mean, you look at, and we've talked about this before, and others have said, and it's not an original thought, that the United States was shaped by FDR, and we lived in sort of FDR's world. As George Will said back in the 1980s, we are all now children of FDR. But from 1932 to 1980, FDR's worldview shaped American politics. From 1980 to 2020, Ronald Reagan's view of the world shaped American politics and really the outlines of the debate. This bill, again, which 76% of Americans support, takes us into a new era. And it's not like the Affordable Care Act. That was a political bloodbath that barely got through and caused great unrest in town hall meetings across America, created the Tea Party movement. This is a piece of legislation that more than 3 out of 4 Americans support, which again shows us that we have moved beyond the Reagan era. Not exactly sure what this era is going to look like, but it's not going to look like the period we are in from 1980 to 2020. So Jonathan O'Meara.
And yes, famed socialist Joe Biden is the one to bring us over there. I mean, it's just it's shocking that Joe Biden is the president to kind of usher in this new era. I don't disagree really with his assessment, to be honest with you.
No, I think that is the case. I don't know what era we've moved into, but I can tell you that when I got to college in 1984, the first thing that my the government professors I had, they came and they said, we have just, you know, gone through a realignment. And it took place then. And I don't know that Joe Biden necessarily, his election per se, represents a realignment. But if just like look at the complete absence of response to this COVID-19 bill
Trump's gutted the Republican response.
The only thing I would say is that we could be living in an era where there is going to be continued wrangling and consternation about what's going on with Mr. Potato Head.
Well, the thing, so, okay, and last point is just that the media learned its lesson when it comes to Trump. They stopped treating the Republican Party with deference, and it's showing in the weakness of the Republican response to the stimulus package, and it's good for everybody.
It's good for everybody. All right, we'll talk more about that tomorrow when we see you then. And for those of you we are seeing now, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. We've got some sad but also, you know, happy news to talk about in the fun half. We're also gotta go. We're not gonna go too long in the fun half today. Gotta go a couple minutes short, but that's okay.
Gotta be quick.
Just a reminder: this program relies on your support. When you become a member of the Majority Report, you support the free show. You get the free show free of ads, and you get the fun half. We can't do it without our members. You guys are hugely important for why this show exists 10 years plus after it launches. jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget AM Quickie, amquickie.com, and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Here is, and okay, we'll read this Girardardis stadium politics quote in a second. Jamie coming on.
Here I am.
Folks, don't forget Nomi's show, not on today, but you can check it out tomorrow. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we have a very special interview with Afro-American Studies professor Toussaint Lozier, as well as Bradley Green, a member of the Chicago Black Panther Party and a contemporary of Fred Hampton's, to talk about the movie Judas and the Black Messiah, which tells the story of Fred Hampton's assassination through the eyes of a snitch. So we talk a little bit about what life was like in the Black Panther Party, Bradley's relationship to Fred Hampton, why the police were set on killing him, what he liked, what he disliked about the movie, and his thoughts on the modern day communist movement and on the George Floyd uprising. And that's out now, patreon.com/theantifada, or wherever you get podcasts. We also have a little bonus snippet from that conversation that came out on Friday for our patrons. So check that out as well. And also we're streaming on Twitch, twitch.tv/theantifada, 3 to 4 nights a week these days, around 7 o'clock. So check that out as well.
Matt.
Also, I just want to say, don't be afraid if you enjoyed Judas and the Black Messiah to watch that. I think particularly if you enjoyed it. I think there can be a tendency on things like this when it's like, oh, things can't be perfect, just let me enjoy it. But you'll actually get a lot of out of it if you listen to the, particularly Jamie's episode on this. But on Left Reckoning, Austin Gonzalez of Machete y Mate came on last Thursday. We talked about Ecuador, Caribbean integration, and a second coming of the pink tide in Latin America. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning for the post game.
All right, folks, we will see you in the fun half, 646-257-3920. And we're taking IMs. You can IM the show via the app at majorityapp.com. See you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back,
just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner D's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The
alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African and the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
You see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on!
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Total, pussy, 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 total, pussy.